From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we discuss some of the most recent news and events around the world with analyst and political commentator Eric Dreitzer. Eric Dreitzer, welcome back. A pleasure as always.
Don, thank you, my friend.
So there's stuff going on all over the world. I thought maybe we could hop, skip, and jump around a little bit. But let's start in that theater of the absurd known as the federal courts in New York.
Okay, indeed.
Sometime last week, there was a mention at one of the UN committees in charge of counterterrorism at the Security Council that the investigation and prosecution of terrorist cases, you know, causes all kinds of, you know, stresses on the justice systems of many countries. And they were talking about going after how, you know, it's hard to balance all the things of human rights, security, you know, terrorism, and adjudicating these cases is hard. But it seemed like almost to prove that point, in a civil court in New York, a federal judge orders the payment of $10.5 billion in damages to 9/11 victims from Iran. What the?
It's almost inexplicable, but I think that there is something – well, look, there's a couple of political issues I think that really kind of rise to the surface here. Obviously, it's absurd on its face because there is no actual evidence or even really convincing line of argument that Iran has any responsibility or culpability for what happened on 9/11. Now, without getting into the specifics about 9/11 and Al-Qaeda and exactly what happened and who did what, because even the 9/11 Al-Qaeda connection has never really been tangibly proven in a substantive way. But assuming that that were true, there is no substantive link between Iran and Al-Qaeda because obviously Al-Qaeda is 100% opposed to Iran, Al-Qaeda being Sunni, Iran being Shia, Iran being the sort of the target of a lot of the Saudi-backed Wahhabi terror networks from which Al-Qaeda is probably the most prominent, although ISIS now is challenging for that position. So the question is, what exactly is Iran's role, quote unquote, in 9/11 here? And the answer is none. There is no evidence. This is a farce of a court proceeding, a farce of a judgment. But the real issue here, and one that I think does merit a little bit of consideration, is the corrupt nature of the U.S. court system, and specifically at the higher levels, because we have seen countless times, especially, you know, the New York Circuit and, you know, and a number of others, where these type of high-profile judgments, high-profile cases that are politically motivated are oftentimes driven by U.S. finance capital. And one specific example that people should keep in mind, of course, is the judgments in favor of Paul Singer against the government of Argentina, overriding Argentina's Supreme Courts, overriding international arbitration judgments, overriding all other international institutions, as if U.S. Judicial system somehow exists above any international system or above that of other nations. And I think, again, what we're seeing here is that U.S. finance capital, the U.S. elites who have deep pockets, who have deep connections to literally all circuit courts, all of the U.S. judicial system, all the way up to the Supreme Court, as we saw with the Scalia episode, this is now playing out in the headlines, playing out in the media as we see the demonization of Iran. Obviously, there are pro-Israel interests on Wall Street, pro-Israel interests all throughout the ruling class in the United States who would love to demonize Iran, who would love to draw out a fabricated connection between Iran and 9/11, and a civil judgment of this kind is a great way to do that.
And, you know, not only that, you've got actually the releasing of Iranian money that had been grabbed by the United States back in 1979, 1980, yep. And suddenly I'm guessing that there's going to be some sort of a motion in that court to execute against that money.
Yeah, exactly. So this is obviously also connected to Israel and the United States, or at least a faction in the United States, doing whatever they can to derail the normalization of ties between Iran and the West as a, you know, sort of the substance of that nuclear deal. Remember that that nuclear deal, by from Iran's perspective, was an attempt to not only normalize, but to then reintegrate into the global economy and to retrieve, as you're alluding to, a lot of those frozen funds. So is this essentially a backdoor way of holding on to that money, of depriving Iran of a significant chunk of money? I mean, what was it, $10.5-11 billion? Yeah. I mean, this is no small amount of money. And so I think that there is an economic component to this. There's also, of course, the political message that is being sent to Iran by certain factions in the West. Namely, don't think for a minute that we are going to let up on you. Don't think for a minute that we're going to take all of this lying down. And obviously, this has a direct bearing on the results of the coming U.S. presidential election, because assuming that things go the way that they look like they're going, when the choice is between Donald Trump and a Hillary Clinton, we know that both of those candidates, both of the factions that they represent, are deeply hostile to Iran, are deeply embedded with the pro-Israel Zionist networks inside of the United States. Of course, Donald Trump's longstanding relations with one of the principal financiers behind the Israel lobby, Sheldon Adelson, mm-hmm. along with a number of others with whom he's very close, including the entire establishment, the pro-Israel establishment in New York City, which is probably the center of the pro-Israel faction in the United States. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton, whose foreign policy is not only blatantly and rabidly neocon, but who has expressed open hostility towards Iran, including having advocated for war against Iran multiple times over the last decade. So this is a very real question that people need to consider. The political reality that is facing Iran given the outcome of the coming elections in November. And I think that this judgment needs to be seen as a component of this larger issue.
You know, it was an interesting statement. There's actually a pair of them, the most recent one, coming out of Obama, speaking with a journalist a few days ago about the sarin gas attack in Syria back in 2013, how one of the things that he's proudest of, he says, to this journalist is the fact that he stood up to the pressure that was being exerted on him from within the government and from without, and didn't bomb Syria. And that followed another repositioning of something earlier that came out a week or two ago that escapes me at the moment. But what the hell is he doing?
Well, look, pardon me if I don't play my violin for Obama's, you know, peace-loving policies here. Obama is a warmonger of the first order. Obama has executed countless innocent civilians in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and many other places. Obama's statement comes at almost the very same moment that 150 people are murdered in Somalia in a really heinous drone attack that, according to the New York Times, killed quote-unquote militants, although they obviously have no way of knowing exactly who was killed, militants being women, children, elderly people, and who knows who else. So, you know, Obama is certainly no dovish figure. He's certainly no peacemaker. However, that being said, it is a very interesting question to consider. Just exact, not whether Obama is, you know, interested in peace, because he's not, but just exactly which forces really were pushing for the bombing of Syria in 2013, because had Obama really wanted to do that, he could have done it without ever talking to Congress. He could have simply ordered it and it would have been done, just as Clinton did in Iraq, just as Clinton did in Serbia, just as Bush did many times, and every other president really has in the last number of decades. So who was pushing for the bombing of Syria? Obviously, there's at least a strong trend in the military bureaucracy, if not the establishment in the military, that was pushing for a bombing campaign in Syria. Obviously, there's no doubt that the Israel lobby, that the pro-Israeli Zionist faction wanted to see Syria bombed, wanted to see regime change for the interests of Israel, of course. And then obviously his Saudi friends in Riyadh and his Qatari friends in Doha and a bunch of others all wanted to see that as well. So did Obama go against, and Obama and the people around him, go against that consensus among, you know, the neocon faction? Possibly. I think that there is a good question to be asked about that. Now, what is Obama trying to do? Obama's trying to position his legacy. Obama knows that his quote-unquote progressive credentials, as far as his legacy goes, rest on whitewashing his rampant war crimes, you know, just as they did for Bill Clinton, just as they did for Jimmy Carter. This is what Democrats always have to do at the end of their term, is to present themselves as peacemakers, as humanitarians, as people who stood up against the warmongers on the right. This is, of course, all nonsense and all propaganda. As I mentioned, you know, Obama's prosecuted at least seven wars during his presidency. And, you know, if we include the various drone bombings, we could go much further than that. So that's really, I think, what we're seeing here. Not so much an interest in Syria, not so much an interest in making peace, but really an interest in whitewashing his own record and his legacy.
And, you know, the reality of the situation actually on the ground back in September of 2013 was quite different, because when they started beating the drums to go to war, first you had the parliament in the UK vote against the UK getting involved, and you started to see a mobilization of the anti-war movement again here. And I'm wondering if he wasn't afraid of provoking, you know, a rise of the anti-war movement again.
I'm skeptical of that, and I say this with full, you know, self-awareness, considering the fact that I was one of those people marching in New York City exactly at that time in the summer of 2013. You know, after the alleged chemical weapons attack in late August, and then in the lead up to a potential bombing of Syria, I remember literally carrying the banner along with people as we marched through Times Square. It was a wonderful experience, because quite frankly, we hadn't had real anti-war activism in the United States since Obama had gotten elected. Right. I mean, barring maybe, you know, a couple of little anti-war demonstrations here and there. So yeah, I mean, I would love to believe that Obama was really afraid of us, you know, a few thousand here and there in New York and Philly and DC and LA and elsewhere. But I think the reality is that Obama was more concerned about driving himself deeper into a quagmire that would be a major, major black spot on his record.
Okay. Let's jump over to China. Over the last week and a half, they've had the two main political groupings, one the inside the government and the other civil society, the National People's Congress and the CPPCC meeting. And at the same time that they're doing that and discussing foreign policy, the economy, and all of that, the United States sends a carrier group, military naval carrier group, a major one, into the South China Sea, starts conducting operations with India in the west part of the South China Sea, has a massive war game scenario going on on the Korean Peninsula, the largest since like 1953. What's happening with that?
Well, this is a continuation of a sort of a belligerent provocation based strategy that the U.S. is employing vis-a-vis China. We've seen this going on for a while now. Now, I think we need a little bit of context here. Yes, of course, we have the Chinese Communist Party's major, meeting, confab, I guess was the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
At the same time, we also need to see this against the backdrop of the recent ASEAN meeting that Obama initiated that was held in California. And what came out of that, or rather what didn't come out of that, was a strongly worded condemnation of China, in regards to the South China Sea particularly. And I think that was a strategic defeat for Obama, for the entire pivot to Asia strategy, because what they wanted was to be able to get all of those ASEAN members from the Philippines and Cambodia and Laos and Malaysia and all of these countries. They wanted to get them all on the same page, that of course being the anti-China page. And there is resistance against that. Vietnam and Laos and some of these other countries that have really tried to play a, let's say, middle road strategy where they have some anti-China sentiment in their ruling circles while simultaneously also being somewhat wary of the United States and knowing that an economic future has to include China in some capacity. And so I think that there's definitely some consternation and some anxiety in the region, in Southeast Asia particularly, against a belligerent strategy that tries to isolate China. And so the United States is really in many ways taking the initiative to stick its thumb in the Chinese eye. And so you have this carrier group, you have this this so-called freedom of navigation issue where the United States is sailing its battleships and destroyers and things like this through basically right up against China's territorial waters. Obviously a provocation. I don't have to, really explain what the United States would do if China did the same thing off the coast of California or off the coast of Florida or what right. have you. So, we understand exactly what the United States is doing. Also, the U.S. is concerned that China is going to be able to establish some level of military dominance over what it sees as its sphere of influence. Of course, there is this ADIZ, that's the Air Defense Identification Zone, which basically would mean that China would own the airspace over a lot of this territory. The U.S. is deeply concerned about that. The U.S. is concerned about its growing assertiveness in the South China Sea, which still is believed to have, I think it's the second largest untapped energy reserves anywhere in the world. The U.S. knows that China is eyeing that very, very strategically, and they want to do whatever they can to undermine that. And then, of course, there is the pretext of the DPRK, North Korea. There is the pretext of the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands dispute. There is, of course, a number of other pretext against which the United States is able to justify this aggressive posture. And then I think at the larger level, there is the economic question. The United States has been pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership to isolate China economically, while China has been pushing the One Belt, One Road economic strategy to integrate further the Eurasian landmass, including Russia, but also all the way into Europe. So there is this competing economic vision. And naturally, the United States is doing whatever it can to flex its military muscle as a counterweight against all of that. And then finally, I just want to add, China's economic crisis, quote unquote, a lot has been written about that in recent weeks. Is China is China just printing more money, quote unquote, funny money that is flooding the global market as a means of propping up its economy? That's what a lot of the Wall Street analysts are saying. I think there is definitely anxiety about how China is going to proceed, knowing the future of its future growth projections are nowhere near what the last decade held for China. How is that going to impact the global economy? A lot of people in Washington and on Wall Street who are very concerned about China for all of these and many other reasons.
You talk about funny money. One of the cute moves that I fantasize about from time to time is China simply dumping all of its paper, U.S. paper, on the market and using that to pay to take its factories back by eminent domain.
Yeah, that would be – that's almost like, you know, the nuclear option for China. You know, I mean, if the United States really forced China into a corner, and I mean in a really aggressive way where you're looking at a potential world war scenario, which I've argued many times is – absolutely possible, yeah. Definitely on the table, and certainly possible given a Trump or Clinton presidency. So, you know, I don't even want to say it's an unrealistic scenario. It's entirely realistic and possible.
Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg that it's possible.
Yeah, it is possible. Now, I don't think that's, you know, necessarily right around the corner, barring a global economic collapse, which, I mean, maybe we could talk a little bit about that potential as well. But I understand that. I think a more likely scenario, though, is that the Chinese could start dumping a lot of other U.S. assets. Look, just as an anecdotal, you know, I have people who work in real estate in California. Real estate is inflated tremendously all over the West Coast, and in particular in Southern California, mostly not only because of hedge funds buying up things and, you know, charging exorbitant rents and all of that, not only because of that, it is a lot of Chinese money that comes into California and buying up hard assets like real estate. Now, what would happen if China put in place a policy where not only do they forbid that, but where they force some of the selling of some of these assets, real estate assets in California, in New York, in Florida, in all of these other places, a lot of the farmland that they have bought. There's so many different weapons at the disposal of the Chinese when it comes to economic warfare that I don't think they would necessarily need to immediately jump to that nuclear option of dumping all of their dollar-denominated debt. But of course, if they did that, the repercussions of that globally would be, you know, almost incalculable.
And, you know, you have the example of the situation that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia created in the oil markets, where now it's basically biting Saudi Arabia pretty hard. You know, you had this essentially the dropping of, you know, the dumping of oil onto the market, the dropping of oil prices. The big hits that were taken by Russia, Iran, and Venezuela in particular, but now Saudi Arabia also feeling it. And here domestically, you have the whole fracking industry, you know, the shale oil extraction industry also really hurting. And there are economic consequences to the United States at this point as fallout from that, too. Could this be a sort of a foreshadowing of some of the kind of big games that could happen if China and the U.S. begin to engage in economic warfare?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, if the United States really does push China, look, I think the great sort of beneficiary of all of that would probably be Russia, because, you know, while there's been a lot of talk over the last few years of how Russia and China have moved closer together economically and all of that, you know, the building of pipelines, the Far Eastern pipeline, the Altai pipeline through Central Asia, you know, these machinations, the move towards settling their trade agreements in their own currencies as opposed to using the dollar, all of these things are true and they're happening, but they're and also the building of a new debt settlement infrastructure away from the SWIFT system controlled by the United States. So all of these processes are happening, but they're relatively slow and they're kind of long term. They don't have the short term consequences that a lot of people, I think, have overstated. But if the United States were to push hard in that direction, it would greatly accelerate the need for Russia and China to really move closer together, to build out that infrastructure, to really, I think, give them the push that they need in order to, I think, grow more economically independent. So, and look, I don't think that they're, that the planners in the United States are not ignorant of that fact. I think they understand that. They're trying to walk a fine line between a belligerent policy and posture against China, but not an overly belligerent one that drives China into the arms of the U.S.'s strategic enemy in Russia. So there is this, I think, this growing question also. Now, ultimately, the United States, at least the capitalist interests in the United States, particularly, of course, the major corporations that are leveraged heavily in the Chinese economy, both financially in terms of the markets, but also, you know, concretely in terms of factories and exports and all of the rest of that. These interests are, I think, in many instances, quite concerned about this growing tension between the U.S. and China. I mean, what would happen to Apple and Walmart and, you know, big retail and a lot of these big agricultural firms and energy companies and all the rest of, what would happen to them if there was a major falling out between the U.S. and China? It would be devastating. China is a massive market. I don't think anybody is, you know, shocked to hear that. I think that there's no way that you can really isolate China without destabilizing the entire global economy.
And, you know, while I'm sitting here wondering if I'm going to have to end up buying a loom to have new shirts at any point in the future, you can look at the, you know, the U.S.'s attempt to pivot to India, and they're conducting these naval exercises with India, for example, as a part of the whole China thing that they're doing, wondering if they're dangling, look, you know, we can make you the next China, we'll build the factories there instead, et cetera. I wonder if that kind of game is going on.
There's no doubt that that's going on, and not only are they doing these, you know, these maneuver, these military exercises and so forth, but there's a lot of other aspects to this growing what would we call it, this growing move to isolate China. One that has gone almost entirely under the radar is the fact that India is on the verge of signing what are called the foundational accords with the United States. India, these are three very strategically important military agreements that would essentially make India into an ally, a military ally of the United States in all but name. I think this, the most significant one is called the LSA, the Logistics Support Agreement. There is, of course, there's also the CISMOA, that's the CISMOA, the Communications Interoperability and Security Memorandum of Agreement, and the BECA, that's the Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement for Geospatial Information and Data. In other words, the United States is going to be able to have full use of Indian military facilities inside of India, as well as providing not only the military contracts, but also providing technical expertise, sharing of intelligence, sharing of data, sharing of communications networks. In other words, the creation of a full-blown military alliance, although India will never call it that because of the history of India's, you know, non-aligned status, or maybe better put, India's historical closeness with Russia and the Soviet Union. But the reality is the right-wing government in India of Narendra Modi, despite all of the, huzzas for Modi's, move towards the BRICS and, you know, his non-Western integration talk, the reality is that he represents right-wing capital interests in India, neoliberal finance. He represents all of those, not only socially and culturally conservative, but economically right-wing elements that want closer relations with the United States. That's now happening militarily, and obviously China is the driving force behind that. India still is quite hostile with China. This hostility has lasted for decades. The United States foments that. It feeds into that, and they want to drive a wedge between the so-called BRICS. In other words, if India is a full-blown military ally of the United States, according to these agreements, which India is about to sign, that basically means there is no such thing as BRICS. You can just take out the India out of the equation. Now, if you want to keep the acronym, you could just add Iran if you wanted to do that, or possibly Indonesia, although both of those countries can be problematic in various ways and for various reasons. But at the end of the day, India is not solidly in the non-Western camp. India is definitely moving closer to the United States, despite the rhetoric and despite its posture.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.